So this, the first scene is a bit of a, it's a prologue, and it takes place on August 11th, 1986. So August 6th, 1986, Berlin. I saw Hitler at a time when the Reichstag was little more than a burnt skeletal silhouette of its former self, and the Brandenburg Gate obstructed passage rather than granted it. It was an evening when the moral remains of the city bobbed up to the surface and floated like driftwood before sinking back down to the seabed to further splinter and rot. Berlin was the last stop on our European tour. We'd worked our way up from Spain, through France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and soon we would be flying home, back across the Atlantic, to start the new school year. My two brothers, still throbbing with energy, lamented that we had to leave. In every town and city, they'd wandered off into the night and not returned until breakfast, answering in cranky monosyllables between sips of coffee whenever anyone commented on the amount of money being wasted on hotel rooms. My two sisters, on the other hand, weighed down by stories and souvenirs, were desperate to unload, and my parents, too, felt weary and ready for home. Not to mention that we'd used up 60% of the money we just inherited from my grandfather, and the remaining 40 had allegedly been set aside for our ever-expanding deli. On our final evening, after an early dinner, our parents announced they were taking us to a demonstration against the Berlin Wall to protest 25 years of this icon of the Cold War. Wherever you went in Berlin, sooner or later you would run into it, even on the day we visited Hansa Studios, where Nick Cave and Depeche Mode used to record, or the second-hand shop that sold clothes by the kilo. No matter where you went, east, west, north, south, before long you hit against the intractable curtain of cement and were able to go no further. That was our impression, anyway. So we figured that we too might as well protest against this seemingly endless structure that limited even our movement, though we were just seven tourists visiting the city for the first time. When we arrived at the demonstration, there were already thousands of people gathered on the west side of the Brandenburg Gate. Young couples, old couples, scampering children, punks with dogs, goths, women with buzz cuts, men in blue overalls, a cross-section looking back of what West Berlin had been in those days. Most people remained standing, but there were also large groups spread out on the pavement, singing and chanting and passing around bottles of beer. Two nights before, we'd heard, a human chain had started to form along the wall with an aim to cover all 155 kilometers. On the east side, meanwhile, men in gray uniforms and steel helmets were marching up and down Karl Marx Alley. I envisioned dramatic clashes between metal and flesh, order and chaos, homogeneity and diversity, but I knew that in real life these clashes were far more abstract. My parents had wanted to take us across the border to show us a true portrait of communism, but there had been a mysterious problem with our visas, so we'd stayed in the West all week, left to imagine as best we could what life was like on the other side, ever more intrigued by notions of this side and beyond. People continued to arrive. The singing and chanting grew louder, and I could hardly hear when anyone in my family leaned over to say something, as though on that night our language had been put on hold and German was the only means of communication. But there were other ways of having a voice, and before long we joined the lengthy chain following the wall, and I found myself clasping the hand of a man with a ponytail and a black leather jacket until one of my brothers insisted on changing places with me. I tried to imagine the thousands of people across West Berlin to whom we would be connected through this gesture of solidarity, but the thought was dizzying, so I focused instead on the punks playing nearby with their dogs, as they threw what looked like battered tennis shoes, which the dogs had raced to retrieve. The punks would then throw the bait in another direction, every now and then missing and hitting someone on the head or shoulder, the sight of which triggered boisterous rounds of laughter. Twilight came on. Some of the organizers walked through the crowd, passing out white candles. A number of people declined and flipped on their lighters instead. Against the sea of lights, the Reichstag looked even gloomier and more forsaken, and the Brandenburg Gate, with its goddess of victory and 12 Doric columns, doubly silenced by dusk. Not far from us, an old punk with a torch jumped onto the wall and screamed some words into the east, rabid words that we couldn't understand what he was saying. On the other side, my mother told us, invisible eyes would be following his every movement. There didn't seem to be anyone in the watchtowers across the way, yet we imagined men in round caps with cat-slit eyes surveying the whole spectacle, ready to pounce should any of us trespass one inch into their territory. We stayed at the demonstration until the candles burned down and the fuel in the lighters ran out and all the voices grew hoarse, until our watches read midnight and people gathered their things and began to leave. We followed our parents down the street, then down many more, in the direction that everyone seemed to be heading. There was no chance of finding a taxi. We would have to take the U-Bahn. So along with hordes of others, we descended into Gleis High X station, like a screaming 800-headed monster. The frenzied crowds made it impossible to get within arm's reach of the ticket machines, so when the next train pulled into the station, we jumped on without having paid. It was one of those nights, we sensed, when anything was permitted. Hundreds of people were crammed into the carriage. It was impossible to even turn around. And with the heat, my sweater began to feel like a straitjacket, but there was barely enough room to remove it. After tugging on the zipper and successfully extracting an arm, I noticed that my family was standing at the opposite end of the car. Swept up with the confusion, we must have boarded through different doors, and now dozens of bodies were between us, though it didn't really matter since I knew where to get off. And as if in some bizarre cubist composition, all I saw were corners and fragments of their angled faces. My mother's lips, my father's nose, my sister's hair, and I remember thinking to myself how this amalgam would have been far more attractive, a composite being, cobbled together from random parts of each, rather than the complex six-person package to which I was bound for life. The train continued its journey, and I began to examine the passengers sitting and standing nearby. There was general mirth in the carriage, and I began to feel as if I was in some kind of aviary, the one populated with less exotic species than those we had at home. Groups of large black and gray birds with blonde tufts laughed and told jokes, while scruffy brown birds with ruffled feathers waved bottles of beer. Solemn birds read the evening paper, others squawked over crossword puzzles, and the smallest birds, of which there were only a few, emitted the occasional chirp, as if aware of the hierarchy but uncertain how to participate. And then I noticed one bird, a bird with unusual plumage, which, unlike the others, didn't seem to want to draw attention to itself. Sitting directly in front of me was a very old woman, nearly a century old, I would say, wearing a scarf that framed a wide forehead, which peered out like an angry planet. She had dark, deep-set eyes and a square, jowly face that was remarkably masculine. Stiff and erect, the old woman sat in her seat, clutching her purse and stared straight ahead. The jowly face, the sweeping forehead, the deep-set, furnacy eyes, everything seemed horribly familiar, and I felt as if I'd seen this face before, but in black and white. Since I was standing directly in front of her, I had the perfect perspective to really study it, and the more I stared, the more certain I was. Yes, that it was Hitler, Hitler dressed as an old woman, riding westwards. This is Hitler, I said to myself. There's no doubt that this is Hitler. The old woman had the same shaped face, the same black eyes and high forehead, and, now that I looked again, even a shadowy square area where the mustache would have been. I stared and then I stared some more, petrified, horrified, amazed by what I saw. All of a sudden, the train jerked around a curve. The woman, startled out of her rigid position and thrown back into the present, finally looked up and around, and it was then that she caught me staring. I couldn't believe it. I was making eye contact with Hitler. Hitler was making eye contact with me, at least for a few seconds. The woman frowned and turned away, then back to me and smiled faintly, her lips barely moving, probably to ingratiate herself since my staring must have unnerved her. My heart pounded. The sight in front of me, added to the stifling heat in the carriage, might have been enough to give anyone a heart attack, even me, at age 14. Yet a heart attack at age 14 was still more probable than seeing Hitler on the U-Bahn disguised as an old woman. How could it be, I wondered, that 40 years after the war, I found myself face to face with the devil himself, the devil whose very name cast a shadow on nearly every landscape of my young life. I waved to my brother Gabriel, who happened to glance my way, and made an urgent sign for him to join me, even if he had to bulldoze his way through the crowd. But he took one glance at all the large Germans standing between us and shrugged. I then pointed at my parents, motioning to him to get their attention, but the fool just shrugged a second time and turned away. My mother, nose deep in a guidebook, was a lost cause, as was my father, busy trying to decipher the signs on the walls of the train. My two sisters were just as useless, huddled together in a conference of whispers, oblivious to everything but each other, and I couldn't even see my other brother, who was eclipsed by at least 10 bodies. My entire family stayed rooted like metal poles on the U-Bahn, while I stood 1 foot away from Hitler with not a witness in sight. To my great surprise, not a single person seemed to notice the old woman in the headscarf. All these birds were simply too caught up in their feather ruffling and gregarious flocking to pay much attention to their fellow passengers, especially to those seated below eye level on a different perch. But how could no one else notice the forehead of the eyes and the shaded patch between nose and mouth, when the combination of these features seemed so glaringly, so obscenely, real and factual present? We plowed deeper into the west. The train stopped at Wittenbergplatz, and then, a few minutes later, at Solnovischergatte. Dozens of people stepped out, freeing up the space considerably, but my family stayed where they were. Now that the crowd had thinned, although there were still quite a few people between us, I noticed strapping men posted at each of the four doors of the carriage, four buzzards in their 60s or 70s, all wearing the same bulky gray coat. There was no need for these coats in August, coats cut from a cloth so thick it barely dented, and I couldn't help wondering whether they were hiding weapons beneath them. Their eyes were riveted on the old lady. Every now and then one of them would turn to study the passengers around her, monitoring their movements with narrowed eyes, but most of the time they just watched her. These are former SS men, that occurred to me, here to guard the incognito hag, aging secret agents who survived the war and have for the past 40 years lived in hiding with their fervor. The old woman raised an arm to rearrange her scarf. Two guards tensed their shoulders, mistaking the gesture fleetingly for a command. I couldn't bear it any longer and again tried to wave my parents over, but my mother was glued to her guidebook, my father to the signs on the train, my sisters to their gossip, and my brothers to who knows what. At Sophie Charlotteplatz, the old woman rose from her seat and brushed past me, her shoulder nudging mine a little harder than necessary. I moved aside. Within seconds, all four men left their stations by the doors and closed in to form a tight circle around her. The train came to a halt. Two of the buzzards stepped out, then the old lady, followed by the other two. The gray gang had disembarked. The doors closed to the train. Its load considerably lightened, continued on its way. No one in my family believed me, not even my brother Gabriel, the most adventurous-minded of the lot. They told me it was absurd. Hitler shot himself in his bunker in 1945. It was common knowledge. His skull had been found by the Soviets and was on display in a museum in Moscow. It was more than enough proof, end of story. 3 years later, the wall fell, and I, in one way or another, grew up. So that's the opening scene, and then, which leaves its imprints. And then, so the rest of the book is narrated post-war Berlin, circa 2007, and the young woman has gone back now, has been living there around 5 years, and has been working for an old historian named Dr. Weiss. So this one is it, this passage. Apart from walks and newsletters and the occasional kiss, the one other activity that kept me busy outside of work was traveling around the city. My love of the S-Bahn and streetcars had far from diminished, and each ride, especially on the S-Bahn, which is the mostly elevated quick train in Berlin. My love of the S-Bahn and streetcars had far from diminished, and each ride, especially on the S-Bahn, was like a thought-ironing excursion, another fix of local anesthetic, and I tried to go as often as possible. Every now and then I felt unprepared for the announcer's voice, as if he were a real person who was suddenly addressing me, but most of the time I'd take a seat and wait for the words to emerge, finding something extremely comforting about a scripted voice and predictable scenery, about knowing exactly what would come next. Old and new, logic and impulse, grit and glamour, all blurred into one long thread as the elevated train bisected the city. Faceless platinum bows, the television tower, the river Spree, the restored facades of the Museum Insel, the Spree again, the shiny metal capitals of the Volksbühne, Aquadome, the Aquarium of the East, dark green treetops, a vast construction site with cranes, orange platypuses grazing on the horizon, more treetops regularly pruned, would leave the east shoot into the west, rows of neoclassical houses with arched beckoning portals, parking lots with graffitied walls, the Spree again, cobblestone streets with neatly parked cars, a long greenhouse, somber official buildings, a church, a harbor of parked bicycles, and much, much more that my overburdened eye always failed to register. And then there were the streetcars, yellow caterpillars by day, articulated light boxes by night, that with quiet strength accordioned their way through the east in tiny processions. My new favorite spot was a little alley behind Hakushimat, where the trams would nap for 10 minutes in rows of three, as still as chrysalises, awaiting their next round. As if obeying some universal cliché, each driver would switch off his motor and step out for a cigarette, the white plume of smoke streaking the darkness. It was a peaceful spot, hidden behind the bustle of the busy junction, and I visited it often that winter, finding something soothing, almost human, about large machines at rest. And then something happened one night on a tram, which made me question what kind of spaces these streetcars really were. I'd been on the way home from buying a bottle of aspirin at the 24-hour pharmacy in Friedrichstrasse, arming myself for what I feared might be a migraine. So far, it was only an increased sensitivity to light and a pianissimo throbbing at the temples, but I knew from experience what might lie in store. At Alexanderplatz, I got off the S-Bahn and walked over to the tram shelter. The circular world clock outside the station had just struck midnight, the television tower illuminated like a long-necked queen from below. All the seats at the shelter were occupied, and I searched for a windproof spot to wait for the M4 tram. The night was chilly, and all I had on was a sweater and my habitual coat, weak ammunition against December. A young couple with cans of beer shared a set of headphones to the left of a melancholic fat man in a blue tracksuit, whose swollen amphibian eyes and plump lips seemed to provide an extra buffer between himself and the world. So far, it was the usual night, with a pitching wind that carried with it the scent of city. A woman, no, a man, in a red cape walked up. He had shoulder-length graying hair, a pronounced stoop, and thick bangs curled under. His eyebrows were finely brushed, and his face was heavy with makeup, yet the effect was oddly discreet. My first guess was that he was an actor, too lazy or impatient to change out of his costume after the show. But another glance at the shiny black handbag and Mary Jane supported my second guess, that he was a transvestite. Like his face, his attire had a prim air, almost demure, far from glitzy or seedy. His black skirt fell to below the knee, leaving visible a pair of chunky calves and skin-colored tights. All heads turned in his direction. The red cape must have been a constant attention grabber, yet the transvestite huddled at one end of the shelter, a meter or so from where I was standing, ignoring the collective stare. At one point he coughed, a husky cough, more male than female. The couple with headphones giggled. The melancholic fat man seemed oblivious. A few minutes later, the M4 arrived. Everyone clambered on. I felt a tropism towards the red cape, or perhaps I just wanted to get a closer look, so I waited until the transvestite found a seat and then took one diagonally behind him. He crossed his legs, adjusted his skirt, which had hiked up a little, and smoothed out his collar. I then watched as he pulled a pocket-sized address book out of his purse and began flipping through pages and pages of blue ink, too fast for me to read anything. The tram marched on to the next stop. A few more people boarded. Someone cursed loudly at the ticket machine, accusing it of gobbling down his change. The man in the red cape turned around sharply to see who had interrupted the piece, and as he did, I got a good look at his profile, brought into fine definition under the harsh light of the tram. I thought, wait, no, it couldn't be, but it was, or was it my imagination? Beneath the careful makeup and the old-fashioned garb, I thought I recognized, and it wasn't the effect of the migraine which had yet to set in. The bossy eyebrows brushed down but beginning to protest, the thick shock of hair escaping from the neat row of bangs of her head, and the stoop. I tried to picture Vice, that's the historian, in a red cape, adding a few brush strokes of makeup to his face. Yes, it was him. I stared at the back of the transvestite's head, willing him to turn around again, but he didn't. Should I tap him on the shoulder and say hello, or would he be horrified at our encounter? And what if it wasn't Vice, but a cranky old queen who simply bore a strong resemblance to my employer? The tram pulled up to the next stop. The caped man turned towards the window and gazed out. He put away his address book. I was tempted, extremely tempted, to lean forwards and tap him on the shoulder. But each time I began to seriously consider doing so, I held back. My stop arrived. I rose reluctantly from my seat. A strong part of me longed to stay on the tram and follow the transvestite to his destination, but all I did was go and stand at the exit in front of him and try to make myself noticed by clearing my throat and then raising an arm to tuck a lock of hair behind my ear. I sensed eyes watching me, but couldn't be certain. The tram came to a halt and I stepped out. My feet touched the pavement, the doors closed. a painted face peered from the window of the glowing vehicle as it clattered up Kleiswanderstrasse, delivering the red cape and its occupant to their midnight rendezvous.